speaker asked me to just maybe speak a little bit about Sangharakshana. And it was interesting watching that that film just now, because seeing this Englishman, like a very ordinary looking Englishman, and very English, and actually who Sangharakshana is, as when you interact with them personally, and the two are incongruent, as we say in English. They're quite almost separate things. And I remember talking with Padmavajra, who's he's effectively the abbot of Padmalaka, the men's retreat centre that you saw in the film there. And he'd been having quite a deep discussion with Sangharakshana just about art, just an aspect of art. And he was just saying there's so much depth there. There is so much there. And most of us just touch a little part of it now and again. And a lot of us have wondered for a long time, I mean, who is this person? And we don't really know, actually. If you look at that man in that film, you know, with his tie, slight paunch, and then walking through the garden, and from nothing, by himself, he's created an international movement, propagating the Dharma that's affected millions and millions of people. And he's translated Dharma into the English idiom. He's brought to life Western culture, art, poetry, the rest of it, in a way that highlights and exemplifies the Dharma. He's created a context, he's created a culture whereby people can actually practice, right across the world. He's quite an extraordinary character, but a very, very difficult to measure, very difficult character to measure indeed. And I first met him in New Zealand in 1978. And before that, in 1976, when I was a young man, 20, and I was engaged in various things, mainly psychedelics and things like that, and living this, climbing mountains and doing things like that. And we used to spend a lot of time reading psychology, religion, meditating, doing yoga, all those sorts of things. And I remember this, some friends of mine had been hitchhiking through the North Island of New Zealand, and they met some people who'd given them this A4 sheet pamphlet. And you opened it up, and there's a picture of Sangharakshana sitting there. And he had really dark, lank hair, and these English hospital glasses, deep, and his teeth all funny, because his teeth got rotted out in India, and it was a long time before he eventually went to a dentist. And this, this almost unbelievable character. And this pamphlet was saying that, he was a very distinguished Buddhist and this and that. And I looked at it, I thought, you've got to be joking. So I threw it in a rubbish bin. And then 2 years later, through various events, I actually got to meet Sangharakshana. I was living in a place called Ratnaloka, which is a mixed community in Christchurch, men and women, in 1978. And it was a big, what we call an Edwardian house in English, built around about 1900. Big old place, lots of rooms, and it was next to a park in New Zealand, about 300 hectare in the middle of the city of Christchurch. And Sangharakshana came, and he used to wear whatever the, it's quite hot in Christchurch in autumn, can be quite hot, but whatever the weather, he used to wear a blue polar neck jumper, woolen, jumper, and this brown rumpled suit. That's what he used to wear all the time. And occasionally he'd put his robe on the outside of it. And I didn't really know him from a bar of soap. I mean, I didn't know Sangharakshana. I'd never seen a film like that or anything. I just heard about him. And I found him an intriguing and fascinating character. And he turned up in our community with an entourage of order members. And I'd been in the habit of getting up at 5 o'clock to do my meditation in those days. And I thought the order members were lazy because they didn't get up to about 7:30. But I realised after they weren't lazy, they were crafty. because they were just giving me a lot of time with Sangharakshita. And I'd finished my meditation by 7 o'clock in the morning, so I'd make his breakfast for him. And he used to answer questions on Buddhism. So I'd just keep firing questions on Buddhism at him, because I'd been studying quite a lot about Buddhism, meditating, you know, thinking, this and that. And he had all the answers. And he used to do his monk's walk, you know, walking up and down in a figure of eight. And we had this long lounge room about as long as this room here. So he'd do about half the length, up and down, just answering all my questions. So I'd just keep asking him questions, you know, make him another cup of tea. And one of the things that really impressed me also, he knew Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami. And I was Govinda and Lee, they went off into Tibet in the early 40s, late 1930s, and they did traced all the Buddhist frescoes and things off cave walls and abandoned monasteries and things. And Lama Govinda wrote a book, The Way of the White Clouds. And he was actually a personal friend of Sangharakshita. Sangharakshita used to go and see Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami and stay with them in India, in Dharamsala. And then he also knew Edward Konza, his friends with Edward Konza. Well, Edward Konza was a German who lived in England. He escaped the Nazis and he translated the Perfection of Wisdom texts. And it's still today is probably the definitive translation of the Prajnaparamita literature. So he was friends with Edward Konza. And he told me this story about Edward Konza. He said that Edward Konza, his first marriage was, Edward Konza was, he was an intellectual, a scholar. And quite a fiery character, by all accounts. And he'd married this very fiery French woman. And of course, they used to fight all the time, so the marriage didn't last. So his next wife was an English Yorkshire girl, and who wasn't particularly cultured or intellectual, but they seemed to get on quite well. And he was telling Sangharakshita this story where he thought, well, maybe he'd culture his wife up a bit. He'd take her to Germany, and she could maybe learn German, and she could get a bit more cultured and stuff. So Edward Konza told her this plan. He sort of broached it to her at the right time, that maybe they could go to Germany and she'd learn to speak German. And she turned around to him and says, "What do I want to learn to speak like a bloody Hun for?" And Sangharakshita thought this is particularly funny. But it's this sort of bluntness of an English Yorkshire woman. So he knew Edward Konza. He also knew Chogyam Trungpa. In the early days up at Sammy Ling and up in Scotland. Chogyam Trungpa was responsible for development of a lot of Buddhism in the United States. And he also knew Alan Watts as well, who probably I'm beginning to display my age now, but for many people of my age, Alan Watts was an entry point into Buddhism, into growth and development. Particularly the book called This Is It and Nature, Man and Women. They were the sort of two big ones. And he had also taught the Dalai Lama English. So I was sort of aware that there was this sort of background to Sangharakshita. But it was sort of, on the surface of it, he's just a pretty ordinary guy. I remember the first night that he turned up. And at that time, I was looking for a context of practice where I could grow and develop and have my own spiritual experience and a system of practice that worked. That's what I was looking for. So the first night he turned up, I remember as I was about to go to bed, and as I was about to lie down on the mattress to go to sleep, I just suddenly felt like this excruciating, beautiful angel who just sort of burst through my heart, out the top of my head, into infinite freedom. And I thought, well, that's significant, I suppose. And sort of, you know, it sort of went from there, really. There's a lot said about things these days to do with spiritual experience, but my experience of Tree Ratner and Sang Ratcher and a system of practice was right from the word go. It worked for me anyway. And the more effort I put into it, the better it worked. So I ended up in England. I spent 10 days with Sang Ratcher and he said, well, just get to England. And I went off to England. Tiny little movement. There was 100 people, there was 100 order members. I knew them all, except for the two, there was a couple of order members up in Finland. But you just knew everyone. And everyone was linked to Sang Ratcher personally. So that was everyone would have a friendship with Sang Ratcher. And that's how it worked. And I remember in the 1981, I went to England in 1980. In 1981, I went on the very first ordination retreat. Sang Ratcher had come up with this idea of doing three-month ordination retreats. And we had there's a young guy, Bob Jones, who'd become Vajrakhetu, who had a friend who owned an old convent in Tuscany, in Italy, near a village called Batignano. Just inland from Grosseto, which is 2.5 hours north of Rome. So we all trooped off to this convent and we were doing this three-month retreat, and that was a really big deal at the time. Yeah, that was a big, big step up. He always seemed to be slightly ahead of the game. You know, he could step things up. And, we sat around meditating, studying, discussing, just practicing the Dharma. In this beautiful Italian convent. It had been built for the Benedictine monks, and I think Napoleon put it out of business in about 1812. So it had long corridors with vaulted ceilings and all little rooms and a loggia and all this sort of stuff. Beautiful. So that was Tuscany. And I didn't get ordained at Tuscany on the first one. There's myself and one other New Zealander didn't get ordained. So, towards the end of the retreat, while everyone else was having order meetings, we had to go and sit on anthills somewhere and rejoice in their merits. Which didn't go very well, I can assure you. And that was my first experience of really coming up against Sang Ratcher. I mean, he wasn't really my sort of bloke, you know. He was gay for a start. Wasn't very athletic, no interest in rugby, very intellectual, you know. I just come up against him, and I come up against this immovable object. Well, not an object, but this immovable force, or a force that was much, much stronger than I was. And that was quite an interesting experience. There was a Scottish order member called Ajita, and he described it as, it's like going head first through a diamond grinder. So that you'd either get the fast treatment or the slow treatment. And if you thought you could take it, you'd get the fast treatment. And the really frustrating thing was he didn't do anything. It was just like, you just somehow, you just get reflected back at yourself. And it was a very strange experience. And quite crushing, really. When I went to Tuscany, I was one of the blue-eyed boys, so my Vajrakhetu and I, or Bob Jones as he was then, the only discussion we really had was who was number one seed, him or me. Well, he got ordained and I come back to England in the baggage cart with the dog and the dirty laundry, you know. And so the only way out of a situation like that is you have to grow and develop. It's the only way you can get out of it. And in fairness to Sang Ratcher, he befriended me. He sort of took me on. And he'd do that, you know, he'd take people on. And he'd befriend you and then just keep working away at it. And I didn't really like him, and we weren't really getting anywhere. And so in the end, I wrote him this letter. I wasn't getting ordained and this and that. And I told him, I just said, look, I think you're a pedantic shit, basically. You know, you're wordy, you're English, you don't say what's going on, this and that, you know. And so then I get this summons to go and see him, you know. So you know, I go to see him, and he's sitting there in this big red chair, because he had this big red chair. And there was all my correspondence all stacked up, you know. And it's stapled. in chronological order. And he says to me, he says, well, some very interesting correspondence. I'm thinking, oh God, here we go. I'd written to him and I'd forgotten some of the things I'd said to him. If you interrupt.
I was just wondering about why does he have that accent? Is it from the years living in India?
Or? Yeah. Well, it's a caricature of his accent.
Yeah, I know.
I was just wondering about this accent. Yeah, it is partly living in India. Because he does talk a bit like this.
I know.
So he said, yeah. And I'd forgotten that I'd written to him. I was trying to annoy him. So I say to him, I'm really into, I was a young man, you know, my early 20s, I'd say, I'm really into sex these days, you know, I'm written these letters, and then I'd forgotten that. And then I'd written him another letter saying I was into culture, you know, I'd be starting to go to opera and things like that. And then I wrote him another letter saying, I'm really going to get enlightened and all this. And not very, what we call, not very well integrated, that's the expression, the technical term. And so he said to me, He said, some very interesting correspondence. He said, good to see you getting into culture. Very good. And I say, oh, yeah. And then he said, one letter. He said, I thought that someone who wanted to get enlightened as much as you would not have been into sex so much. So he sort of had me. It's like sometimes when you talk to Sangharakshan in that way, you feel a bit like an insect that's been pinned to a specimen board. He's just, it's like his mindful. He looks at you, it just goes straight through. And he had me. So I sit there squirming away. And I said, I guess I was feeling a bit reactive when I wrote that. And then he just laughed. He said, yeah. It's like you're saying to me, this is who I am. So put that in your pipe and smoke it, you know. And he just thought it's funny. And I'd also communicated to him that I didn't actually like him personally. And, the letter, you know, calling him this and that. And he said, it's fine. It doesn't matter. He said, we don't have to like each other. He said that the relationship's about something more fundamental than that. So it's not a question of likes or dislikes or whether we fit personally. You know, it's something to do that's fundamentally spiritual. And he just laughed. He said, you know, what did you think I was going to do? Cast you into outer darkness. You know, what do you think I'm God? and then from that time on, our relationship improved. And what he pointed out to me, that I was trying to go around him. And what I had to do was actually communicate to him. I had to communicate what I thought. And what I thought was, I don't like you very much, and the rest of it. And that was fine. That wasn't a problem. So once we cleared that up, then, I started to get to like him, and the relationship started moving forward. And that's what he was like. The whole process was quite interesting. And then it wasn't long after that that I ended up getting ordained. You know, just things started to move along. I remember another time at the London Buddhist Centre in the early 80s. Yeah, the London Buddhist Centre now, I think the property portfolio is worth about 400 million kroner or something like that. When I arrived at the London Buddhist Centre in 1980, it was going bankrupt. It didn't have two pennies to rub together. And there was all sorts going on. I wasn't English. I didn't really understand the English. And, there was a lot of promiscuity and there was people doing drugs and there's all this going and that going on and people arguing and people going to the pub a lot and all this sort of thing. You know. And everyone had ideas about what Sangharakshita should do about it. People thought, well, something's got to be done about it because we're supposed to be a Buddhist movement. And, it's getting a bit leery, as we say in English. I don't know if there's, leery is, it's getting a bit out of balance. And people said, oh, he should do this and he should do that. And some people thought he should go down and wave the big finger and other people should go down and sort it out. And other people, But what he did do was he wrote a book called The Ten Pillars of Buddhism, which we study now on the men's and women's ordination process. And then he went down to the London Buddhist Centre and presented it as a paper. And it was basically a paper, a long paper on ethics and the importance of ethics. And he highlighted and illustrated to people, you know, the importance of ethics, why we practice ethics individually as a community, so on and so forth. And then that became like a standard document for the study of ethics within the movement. And that did work. Do you know, I mean, if you want to see a blueprint for how an urban centre should run and relationships between men, women, children, all the members and the rest of it, go to the London Buddhist Centre. You know, it's very, very good. It's very impressive what they've done there. And that's how he would sort of resolve things. That's how he would do things. So he often had just a much broader perspective than anyone else. So it ended up, I went off to the second Tuscany. And I remember I'd go and see him sometimes because he'd taken me on. I had quite, you know, liberal access to him. And sometimes he would just rave. He'd be wanting to talk about something, you know, quite unusual about politics or this or that. And I think sometimes he just liked to have somebody he could talk to as a friend. And being a New Zealander, I was never much of a sort of faith or worship type, you know, so I'd sort of take him as he was. And I think he quite liked that. It was quite straightforward in some respects. And, we spent a lot of time just talking with him about all sorts of things. He's a very, very clear thinker, but then at the same time, he's politically quite conservative. Yeah, you think, well, you know, everybody who gets enlightened, well, they must vote, you know, they must be sort of left-wing and socialist. Well, not so. How some of it works, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, a person's, you know, the spiritually mature, a person still is a person. They have their identity and their way of seeing things and doing things and the rest of it. And, the second Tuscany was great. And one of the things we had at Tuscany was we would be studying a text. One of the texts was Gampopa's Dual Ornament of Liberation. And then we would have a session with Sangha, actually, and then we would break down into small groups. And we would have, you know, five or six of us just having an informal discussion with him every so often. And I think this is how he worked it with the women order members and mitras as well at the time. So we do a lot of time studying. He took us through the various visualizations, pujas, things like that. And then, of course, there were the private ordinations. He used to do all the private ordinations and all the public ordinations at that time. And I remember once that on the second Tuscany, one of the things I remember was just sitting by him, and we were just meditating in the shrine room, and then I just experienced this just a lot of gold light and a lot of maitri, you know, just love. Just very, very pure, very strong, very direct. It's like a voice just saying, well, this is all there is to it, but don't forget about other people. Now, whether that was him or not, I'll never know, because I never bothered to ask him. But this, you know, lots of people had this type of experience around them. You know, quite often you go and see him and you might come away and you feel really pure for about 3 or 4 days, just, or full of joy. Other times you come away feeling deeply disturbed, as if the rug had been pulled out from under your feet. And I think with the spiritually mature, it's not they don't do anything in a self-conscious, manipulative sort of way. It's almost like just the chemistry, just being an association, just those sorts of things look after themselves. So I think enduring memories of his qualities is his patience. He's very patient with people. The other thing is his empathy. He's always very, very good at being able to put himself in other people's shoes. So imagine what it would be like to be that person and how it would feel and how it would seem to that person. He's very good at being able to empathise. And he actually had a very good sense of humour and fun as well. He's always up for a laugh. He never tipped into hilarity that I ever saw, but he had a very keen sense of humour. And he always emphasised to us too, you know, when we're doing centres and things, just to be patient with people. He'd imitate us, you know, saying, well, you know, you've been coming along here for 9 months, you know, and you're still not a vegetarian. You're not even thinking about moving into a community. I mean, what are you doing? You're only meditating for 20 minutes a day, you know. And he was saying, you know, we need to be patient with people. He said, it might take someone 2 years to decide to become vegetarian. It's a big decision. They have to change their food structure at home. They've got to change the way they relate to their family, their friends. And so he always counseled us to be just very patient with people and helpful towards people as well, and try and relate to them from a basis of metta. And in the early days of the movement, and I think even in the later days of the movement, he didn't have a plan. He never had a plan, as far as I know. He just used to encourage positive developments and try and put out fires where he saw them. And he put his energy with people who were interested in the Dharma. That's one of the things about him, is his complete commitment to working for the Dharma. That's what he does. That's the direction he's going in. You can go with him, but he's not going to deviate. He won't deviate off that course. So it's just this very, very strong sense of commitment and conviction about what he's doing. And in the process of doing it, he didn't have a plan. It's as if he just set something in motion and just saw where it went. And it really depended on who came along. You know, for example, Subhuti was the early architect and lawyer of the movement. You know, he was the only one who'd come along. He seemed to be capable of doing that early work, which was, you know, we had to get a legal system up and running and work out sort of how we were going to do things. And then more evolved from that. You had Dharma Dinner come along, Sangha Devi, they sort of got things moving on the woman's side. It really just depended who came along and who did what, to how the movement developed. And I think some point Sona, a long time ago, decided he wanted to go to Sweden. I'm not sure why. Maybe he liked the idea of kayaking in the archipelago, or thought, you know, Stockholm was a good city or something. I don't even know if he'd been to Sweden, but anyway, came up here and started the centre up. And that's how the movement developed. So he didn't have a plan. And I think during the years, I just kept up regular contact with Sangharakshita. I normally go and see him about in the afternoon slot, about 4 o'clock. So I'd get from 4 o'clock to 4:45. So yeah, basically a couple of hours. And then we'd have lots of discussion about Dharma normally. Longer than 20 years, I intensively studied conditioned co-production and the perfection of wisdom. And Sangharakshita just used to encourage me in that, but he never used to say much. And a lot of the time he'd just look out the window. You'd say something, he'd just look out the window in the opposite direction. I think he eventually paid me a compliment, first one ever in my life, just before I came to Sweden. Christmas before last, Sangharakshita paid me a compliment. That was like, yes. So you don't get medals in Sri Ratna. There's no medal ceremonies, you know, for, you know, if you gain insight or you do exceptionally good work in a centre. He might say, well, you know, well done. Now maybe you can go and do such and such. And his message was, well, you know, you might get somewhere if you work hard. That was Sangharakshita's message. So it's like really inspiring, eh? Yeah, it's like, he wasn't ever very competitive on the international guru market. He's a very difficult character to market in that respect. I remember once I was working on the ordination team in Padmaloka in the late 90s, and I'd cooked up this thing. I was doing a lot of meditation at the time, and you can move very quickly. And I decided that the Vajrayana was actually a faster path to enlightenment. That's what it was, the three yanas. And the Vajrayana, you would get enlightened quicker. And I'd worked out the schema with Amitabha and all this, you know. About. So I went to see Sangharakshana. It's like he could read my mind, you know, because he's sitting there on the couch, and he looked sensationally uninterested. And he says to me, "Well, what is it then?" So I gave him this big scheme, you know, with, based on Amitabha, where the Vajrayana is the fast way to enlightenment. And he's looking out the window the other direction, and he let me finish, and he goes, "Well, no." He goes, no. He goes, "I don't think so. No." He said, "No, I don't think so." And then he just said, "There's no higher teachings." He said, "There's deeper understandings, no higher teachings." He just said, "Stand here. It all depends how hard you work." He said, "If you work hard enough, you can get enlightened with the Theravada." End of conversation. It's a very short session, that one. And he was very good like that, because I always felt secure with him. Because I didn't want to go for refuge to a clown. I didn't want some charismatic, you know, person, you know. I mean, I wanted to go for refuge to someone who was the genuine article, and who I had complete 100% confidence in. And I remember on the second Tuscany, when I went to the second Tuscany, because I didn't get ordained on the first one, and it's a really bad experience. You don't want to go on an ordination retreat and not get ordained. So the second one, I had my money in my bag, in my pack. I had my airfare. I had my money at airfare out of Pisa Airport. I said, "Look, I'm not blackmailing you, but if I don't get ordained on this one, I'm not sticking around. I'm out of here." I said, "I'm just telling you how it's going to be, that's all." And on the second one, before I went, people had said to me, "Oh," they said, "he'll ordain you for humanitarian reasons, if nothing else." And I knew for absolute fact that if he didn't think I was ready for ordination, I wouldn't be getting ordained. Even if it meant, you know, I went and put a rope around my neck and jumped off the loggia, you know, he still wouldn't ordain me. And it was that sort of which gave me confidence to go for refuge to him as a teacher. And when you go for refuge to Sangharakshana, at a certain point he steps out of the way, and then you're left facing the Buddha. And that's how he works. He was never, that I saw or to my knowledge, into the cult of personality. He never did that. And I think one of the real highlights in my relationship with him over the years was in the early 2000s, and I'd probably 2002, 2003, and I'd been to a Tree Ratna day at Birmingham. In those days, we used to have a day, which was FWBO day, it was called in those days. And everybody would turn up, and there'd be talks and this and that, and little market stalls and everything, the whole thing. And we'd hire these really big venues. And towards the end of this day, I was just walking along, just outside the main hall, and Sangharakshana came out, and we just sort of bumped into each other. And he just quite sort of spontaneously, in a very friendly, light way, just said, "Ah, Kuyavadra." And he's just really pleased to see me. And I was pleased to see him. And I felt that was a real blessing, because it wasn't to do with, you know, me wanting a father substitute or wanting something from him or this or that. It was just two friends meeting, and we were pleased to see each other. And just that moment of mutual recognition, you know, when you meet a friend and you're just delighted to see them. And that was a real thing for me, just that sort of getting to that point of Sangharakshana was just that friendship. But I think also, you know, one doesn't want to get the idea that somehow this is special between Sangharakshana and me. Because you talk to, you know, 3,000 other people who have the same relationship. And that's when you start thinking, who's this guy, you know? Because that's how he is. You know, it's just that there is that, he just has that friendship, spiritual depth with lots and lots of people. And across a wide range of interests and circumstances. Both, you know, men, women, children, monks, nuns, married people, the rest of it. So your relationship with Sangharakshita is special only in as much as he has special relationships with everyone. And yeah, that's quite pleasing as well. And against this is the background of him as a character, and he's just quite an unusual character, actually, even by English standards. His Sangharakshita is an unusual character. I mean, he's almost slightly Victorian, but then he's this sort of gentleman with slippers. And you go and see him, and he's so normal that he's abnormal. He's just a very unusual character. So yeah, he's a character you saw in the film, but you often, or a lot of times, just feel that you just get glimpses of him. Very difficult to see the whole man. And I think over the example of his life, just by way of conclusion, he's very kind. His kindness towards people, very considerate. His integrity as a human being, he's a lot of personal integrity and very well-developed ethical practice. And he has an unswerving commitment to Dharma work and spiritual development. I remember talking with Saraha recently. Saraha had been looking after Sangharakshita, or being his secretary and attendant for a couple of years. And I said, well, what's it like? And he said, well, this is his image. In English, you have a thing called a steamroller. I don't know if you have steamrollers in Swedish. And in England, you used to have these big, heavy things with rollers that would roll the roads. And they used to run on steam.
On that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and the term still exists today, like a steamroller. Mm-hmm. So even though it might run on diesel or electricity, we still call them steamrollers. I'll get a steamroller. And it just means something's really heavy that'll roll a grid. And I said to Saraha, I said, what's it like, you know, working with Sangharakshita in that way? And he said, well, it's like a steamroller. He said, that just does 3 miles an hour in a particular direction. But it never stops. It just keeps going. So I said, well, what do you do? He said, well, it's quite interesting for a while. And then you get a little bit bored. So you sort of start, you just run around it, lap around it for a while and run around until you get tired, and then you sit down. And he said, but it just keeps doing 3 miles an hour. He said, and then you go off, you know, and you go and visit someone, or you go to town and you come back, and it's still there, just doing 3 miles an hour. That's how it works. And he sort of built this whole culture, this whole context, just out of his day-to-day work, just steadily, mindfully, but never deviating. And this is my opinion, but I think history will reveal to us that Sangharakshita is a major Buddhist figure. Just from a study of the Dharma, I think he's quite close to Atisha. And Atisha basically founded modern day Buddhism in about 12th century. I think Atisha went over to Tibet. He's got a lot of similarities to Sangharakshita, and I think Sangharakshita is of that sort of stature of figure, like maybe Nagarjuna and Atisha. He's got a tremendous amount of depth, and he's an innovator and a translator, and he set something in motion. And I think what we're seeing with Tri Ratna at the moment is just the very early days. It's just the beginning of something, but it's been set in motion. I think we will go the distance as a Buddhist school. You measure Buddhist schools by the hundreds of years, not by, you know, 100 years, you know. If we're still here in 400 or 500 years' time, you know, we've done the job. And I think we have all the aspects and ingredients to do that. I basically think my experience is our system of practice works if you do it. And I think society is going to change a lot, probably in the next 30, 40 years. I think there'll be major changes. And I think our strengths will be reflected in that, in those changes, particularly to do with community. I think we have a very cohesive international community. I think the thing with Sangharakshita, it's that when you stand at the foot of a mountain, you have no idea how big or high it is. I think we're very close to them. So, it's difficult to see it. And that's just what I think. And history will reveal whether what I think is true or not. There's a saying that nothing gets lost in life. So we shall see. So I hope that's given you a few reflections on Sangharakshita, and maybe just try and open it up a wee bit more multifaceted. But if you talk to 20 order members who've known Sangharakshita from the early days, you'll get 20 different stories. And I think that's one of the really interesting things about this whole process that we're involved in. Yep. So, I'll leave it there.